So I'll just write them on the board here. So this is for people that are doing the project. You know, feel free to choose your own project. Just let me know what it is before you get too far into it. But if you need suggestions, here are some suggestions. So, and you know, most of these are kind of probably on the particle physics side of things, just because those are the easy for me. But so, so some of these are things that are on the list of topics, which if someone chooses them as a project, I won't do them on the topic. Or I can talk on different things, but one of them is, so effective field theory, string theory. So the way in which effective field theory arises in string theory and the alpha prime expansion and things like that. There's a field theory and Clebsch-Klein theories. So how do you handle high and low energy theories with extra dimensions? There's anomaly matching. There's that quantum gravity. And here there's various one loop calculations that have been done in gravity that you could talk about. There's things like grand unified theories. And there's a whole bunch of them in particle physics that I won't list explicitly, but if people are interested in, maybe I'll just put it as a thing, EFT, particle physics. In condensed matter physics. And there's a whole bunch of topics in those two, but any questions before we start?
Yeah, I have one question about what you did last time. Just when you're talking about vacuum connected graphs,
yeah,
and you had like lines going out to sources with an X,
yeah.
What does that mean compared to an actual external line going out? Like, what does the X mean? Because I always thought, I guess how I've always seen it was like the way you presented it, I thought the X was representative of the source. But my understanding was if something was going out to a source, that was just an external line. Like that was the idea of an external line. You just, when you wanted to insert things flowing in and out of your system, you just put a source in and you put an external line.
Yeah, so that's to do with in general, the whole story of Feynman rules. That, let me just unhook that chair. You know, every vertex and every internal line, every external line, there's some sort of a thing you're supposed to write down in the expression. And so for the external lines, you know, if we had been calculating something like, you know, the time order product of phi I of x, phi j of y, let's say, that was the thing that was this path integral. E phi, e to the I, action of phi. Right?
Yep.
And in perturbation theory, what you're doing is you're writing this thing as a quadratic piece plus the interactions, and you're doing a series of the interactions. And that's how you're getting the vertices, and the internal lines are the inverse of the quadratic part in the action. But in this kind of a thing, if you had some sort of a, so if you had, you know, let's say that we had S was some quadratic thing. So 1/2 phi I delta I j phi j. So this is might be box or it might be whatever is going on. And then let's say S interaction. This is S naught. And S interaction is integral d4x. And let's just say it's lambda phi to the fourth just to make it concrete. So then in our Gaussian expansion, when we look in powers of this, we're making some sort of a graph where we have, in this particular case, we would have an external line for each of these guys. And then there'd be something in the middle here. So if we, a particular graph might be, you know, if we had a line, a graph like this, say. So here we have two vertices, three internal lines and two external lines. And these external lines, you know, where they're coming from, where the lines come from is you had, you know, you write this as being, this path integral as being integral d phi of e to the I integral 1/2 phi del phi, phi I, phi j, and then we have 1 plus I s interaction. And then the thing is that we're looking at polynomials with different numbers of phi's here, and then the way we did the integral was for every pair of phi's, we pair it off with an inverse delta, and then the graph is just telling you how you did that. So this way, in this particular way, we had two vertices, and we had two external lines. So these two of the phi's in that are being paired off are these two that were here in the yeah. And so the whole answer depends on them.
Exactly.
And so that's what the external lines are telling you. These are the guys that are the external dependents of the answer. And so in this pairing off of inverse propagators, some of them are going to end, we're going to be pairing this with somebody in here, let's say.
Yeah.
In this particular case, we've taken, we've paired off one external line with one of the vertices, and we've paired off the other external line with the other vertex. And so that means that the Feynman rule that you would get here, you know, for this line, we'd have delta inverse or some Green's function. You know, ik, I guess, x, you know, z, if you like. And then in here, there's something involving a k. There's some. If I'd written this in terms of phi I, say lambda I, j, k, l, phi I, phi j, phi k, phi l, then here we'd have a lambda k and then three other indices, da, da, da. But the answer will depend on x and I through this end of this line. And so you should think of, in this case, the external line is telling you that there's a dependence on, say, I and X here, dependence on J and Y here, and that's similar for every external line.
And what was the difference between when you did that and when you put an X at the end of each
story? So the difference is now, that was that story. So that's kind of your basic external line. If you'd been doing scattering, it would have been slightly different, because for scattering amplitudes, you're taking the Green's functions and you're removing the poles. So there's a rule for getting from Green's functions to scattering amplitudes that I didn't go through, but there's an algorithm. And what you do is you essentially amputate the propagator on the external line and you replace it by a wave function. So there's so that just means there's a different rule for what the external line means for scattering amplitude, but it's a precise rule. So now what we were calculating was not this. We were calculating e to the I w of j was integral d phi e to the I s of phi. Integral j I phi I.
Yep.
So now what's happening, and j was perturbatively small in the story I was telling. And so now what's happening is that the thing that the answer depends on is j. And so you'll see those j's when you'll again write this as being s naught plus s interaction. And you'll Taylor expand in the powers of s interaction. We're also going to Taylor expand in powers of this. Because we were interested in this as a function of as a power series in J, because the idea was that it's coefficients to that with the correlation functions. So the rule here now is that if I expand this out and I look at a particular term, I'll have S naught of phi, you know, 1 plus I S interaction plus da da da, but also I integral J of phi plus that squared, you know, I squared over 2 integral J I phi I. Dx integral j k phi k dy and so on. So now the only difference is that now there's no explicit phi's here anymore. but there are j's, and so the external line is now going to be, the previous rule would have been it's a dependence on some line ends, and it depends on x and I, but now we're supposed to contract that with j and integrate. So it's the same kind of rule. So the rule, here would be that this means whatever you had here. So this is something that ended with I and x, and I take it and I multiply it by j I of x, and do integral d for x.
Okay. So the x is just basically an external line, but you're also including that.
Yeah, but this, but I'm folding it with j, because I'm tracking the functional dependence on j now, not on position x and I. And then when we were calculating e to the I gamma, the idea was it was the same thing, so ditto, but the special thing was that ji was now being evaluated minus d gamma d phi I. So everywhere you calculate, you instead of multiplying by this, you multiply by this.
Right.
And this is regarded, because now we're tracking phi as some specified field.
Yep.
And the special thing here was that everywhere if you had some sort of a graph that was reducible, this condition here was saying that, if this Feynman rule is what I called that, this condition was essentially saying that this was equal to minus sum of all graphs with one line coming off. That's what that boiled down to. So that meant that if I added this plus this, basically, these are two different things, let's say, plus the other one. That essentially cancels. That the condition that the current is minus the derivative goes through and removes all these graphs that have just one line on them.
So the one thing I was wondering though was if it's the sum of all one particle irreducible graphs, aren't those tabular graphs one particle irreducible?
Yeah, but no, in the sense that, I guess in a trivial sense, that if you think of that as a graph, but it's But before you make this statement, there's nothing special about irreducible graphs. Because if you're calculating W, the rule is you're calculating all the connected graphs. Because it would have been all the graphs, but then you took the logarithm to get W, and that's connected graphs. Same thing's true here. Slightly different Feynman rules, because you had to subtract J times phi to get gamma. So it changes what the current coupled to a little bit. But the bottom line was, you're doing all the connected graphs again, but then when you evaluated this J, so the connected graphs included this and graphs like that and like that. These are just three different graphs. But once you evaluate at this particular J, what's happening is that these graphs are canceling and then leaving you with only the one particle irreducible graphs.
Right. So could you explain just one more time why evaluating at that particular die, gamma die, phi, makes it so that that you replace a current source with a external line, or basically that you can connect with that.
Well, it's not that the current source is the external line; it's that the x is being replaced by the whole blob.
Oh. Okay.
So this line is that line, and then that's because the action is essentially the sum of all graphs with no external lines. And then I'm adding by differentiating, I'm effectively putting a vertex in everywhere I could, and that's giving me this thing. Okay. I need just a little bit more weight here. Don't let me forget this. Okay, so, yeah.
Is it possible that we have a path integral and then S transforms, for example, under a particular transformation, for example, complicated transformation,
okay.
S goes to something else, and then the measure goes to something else, but the whole story becomes, invariant under the transform.
So S is not invariant, but the measure is also not invariant,
yes.
But gamma is invariant. Yeah, that is possible, yeah.
That's possible.
And the simplest example of that you will see later on is if supposing you just used some stupid regularization scheme, like you cut things off, like I'm going to do, cut things off, you're going to break gauge invariance, you're going to break a whole bunch of symmetries. And so you can think of that as when I precisely define that measure is now no longer gauge invariant because it involves cutoffs, which are not gauge invariant. But then the thing that what you'll see is that damage can be undone by adding counter terms to the action that are also not gauge invariant in such a way that the answer is gauge invariant. And so
there's no transformation here, just a copy.
Well, that's a particular, but that's a particular example where the measure was not invariant and the action was not invariant, but the answer was invariant. So the thing is that so that leads to the question that if someone shows you that the action is not invariant or the measure is not invariant, you could then ask, well, can I undo that damage by changing the action? And so the important part of the definition of an anomaly is, so if you could have undone the action, if you could have undone the damage, what that would mean is that there would exist a bunch of local counterterms in the action whose change that are not invariant, but whose change is canceling the change of the measure. And the definition definition of an anomaly is not that the measure is breaking the symmetry. It's that the measure is breaking the symmetry and you cannot remove it by a local counterterm. And that's why that rider is in there, is that if you can remove it by local counterterm, then you didn't really break the symmetry. So you demand that an anomaly is something where the variation of the measure is something which is not itself the variation of something local, because the actions always, counterterms are always local things, as you'll see in a second. So that's the important distinction.
Another question is about world identity. So it's often said that the world identity is another version but for the quantum action. Yes, is that correct?
Yeah. There's also world identities for the classical action. The world identities are actually, field theory books make it sound complicated, but actually world identities are really stupidly easy.
The question is that maybe world identity is true, you know,
yeah.
It's an identity, but it's optional. Is that possible?
It's not even that complicated. So let me give you a word identity in just for functions in a way that you'll just see that there's nothing. So the off-shellness, on-shellness will be, the word identity is a statement about that if I have a functional that's invariant under symmetry, that implies identities that the derivatives of its functional have to satisfy. So the off-shell, on-shellness will just be, if the thing that you're talking about had derivatives that were off-shell, then that's an off-shell statement. If the thing you're differentiating was something whose derivatives were on-shell, then that's an on-shell statement.
So it's obvious that, you know, variance is true if the measure is invariant under symmetry. So this is the only way we can use the symmetry of the, you know,
so what you're saying is true. Let me. That's because that's all a statement of, you're asking whether or not, say, gamma is invariant under the symmetry. That's where the measure comes in. Once you know gamma is invariant under the symmetry, you don't have to care whether it was invariant, the measure and the action were invariant separately, or if they're canceled. Once you know gamma is invariant, then there's things you can say about its derivatives, which is what the word identities are. But you could have also said, if once you know the classical action is invariant, there's things you can say about its derivatives that are equally true, and those are the classical word identities.
So the problem comes when we want to, you know, to solve or to prove the identity in path integral version.
Yeah.
You know, in path integral version, the only usage of the symmetry is that the measure is invariant under symmetry. So this is the only usage of the symmetry.
No, because normally you're interested is the classical is gamma invariant under the symmetry, because there's consequences that it has, and then the argument normally people 30 years ago would have assumed was true, was that if the classical action was invariant, then the quantum action would have to also be invariant. And that wasn't necessarily true. So now we know that you have to ask, is if the classical action is invariant and if the measure can be made invariant, then the quantum action will be invariant. But what you're interested in is whether or not the quantum action is invariant. And the word identity statement is just that if you have a function, you know, of three variables, x, y, and z, but it's really a function, it's rotationally invariant. So it's a function only of r squared, where r squared is, you know, is x squared plus y squared plus z squared. And I call, you know, x sub I is x, y, and z. Then, you know, this statement is the statement that, so another way of writing that would be that I have a function, I want to make sure I write this in a way that's going to be useful. So I've got a function of x I, which has the property that it's always equal to a rotation matrix R I j times X j, right? That's the rotation invariant statement for an arbitrary orthogonal R. So now the important thing is that this is true for all X. That's the important thing. And because of that, it remains true if I differentiate it. So if I differentiate, then I'll get that df dxi is going to be, you know, the derivative of this, then the chain rule will be derivative of this, then the derivative of that times X. So it'll be df dy j times r j I. And that's also true for all x. And I can differentiate that again, and I get another thing involving second derivatives. And in this case, so this is a word identity. That's all it is. It's just a statement that if you have a symmetry, which is true for all values of the fields, then if you differentiate it over and over again, you still get true statements. And then the word identities are just the list of all the statements you get for the derivatives. That's all they are. So it's more interesting if this is a nonlinear function, because then it relates, you know, second derivatives to first derivatives and things like that. But that's all a word identity is a statement that if you have a symmetry for all values of the fields of some quantity, its derivatives satisfy the differentiated statement that is invariant.
So in path integral proof of the word identity, what are the assumptions at first?
So the issue would be, you know, you write down e to the I gamma phi, let's say, from which you can get all the Green's functions, say. And in terms of integral d phi, e to the I action of phi plus I. And in this case, the current coupled to, it was phi plus curly phi, and the current coupled only to the fluctuation of phi, right? That was the thing I showed you last class. So there's a statement like this, that there's a path integral representation of gamma. So now the statement would be that if you have, if J is equal to minus d gamma d phi I. So the statement is that if the action is invariant, what you're interested in is if this is invariant under a symmetry, then I can prove a whole bunch of properties of its derivatives being invariant by that kind of argument, and that'll relate the Green's functions. And then that will also relate things like scattering amplitudes and everything else, because this is the thing that when I differentiate it, it gives me the things I'm going to calculate observables with. But what I typically know is that the classical action has a symmetry, and then you want to know, is it sufficient for the classical action to have a symmetry to infer that this action also has a symmetry? And what you do normally is you do a change of variables here, which is the symmetry transformation on the action, and then you have to kind of argue what happens to the current term. But because you did a change of variables for which this is by assumption not changing, if it was true that the measure didn't change, then you can normally derive that this is not changing. So then the anomaly issue is whether or not there will exist a measure which is invariant under the symmetry as well as the action being invariant under the symmetry. And then you'll be able to conclude that this is invariant, and then all the consequences of the symmetry you can apply to all the quantum Green's functions.
But identity is stronger than the assumptions we made.
Word identity is the same as the statement that this is invariant.
Yeah. So it's stronger than saying that, for example, S and the measure are both invariant. Because it's possible that none of them are invariant, but the gamma is invariant, and so if we take the derivatives, then we
right.
have the variance.
Right. But you could make the same statement that if I say the classical action invariant, then there's a derivative of all its derivatives, which is the analog of the statement I make for gamma, just by differentiating the invariance of the action, and that will be a classical word identity. It's a statement that the classical Green's functions are related in the following way because of the symmetry. And even if an anomalous symmetry, then you'd be able to say the classical Green's functions have this property, but the quantum ones don't because they transform differently. If this had not been invariant, if this had been this plus something else, I could still differentiate it and get it something that's true. It's just that I'll have something else on the right-hand side. And so that'll be an anomalous word identity. Okay. All right, so I want to, we've done this whole story. The bottom line of this was kind of a something that you would do in a field theory course, and it's just a convenient way to express all the Green's functions in a kind of a formal way for which there's a well-defined perturbation theory and where this path integral can be evaluated explicitly. And in the semi-classical approximation, I guess the one thing, so the other thing I showed in the very end of last class was that if we have a semi-classical approximation, by which I mean that the action is 1 over a small thing times the action, and implicitly if I'm going to be doing a saddle point thing, I'm thinking that it's the action near the saddle point is order 1. Remember when we did the toy model, I could scale out lambda in front of the action, provided that the fields were of order 1 over root lambda. And it was also true that the minimum potential was order 1 over root lambda, and that was kind of important for the whole argument. So if it's true that the saddle point of the action is such that If I'm near the saddle point, the total action can be written as 1 over a small number times something which is order 1, then this is kind of playing the role of h-bar, because really if I put the h-bars back in, you know, on dimensional grounds, there's always an h-bar here. So the everywhere you had an h-bar appearing, you're getting a lambda appearing. And the point of the of this was that in this case, when you're doing integral of e to the I, something order 1 over lambda, then this expansion I'm talking about it counts. Higher terms in the expansion are suppressed by powers of lambda in a very specific way. And the specific way is each loop costs you an extra factor of lambda, is the statement. So the lambda counts loops in the graphical expansion of integral d phi. So in this whole story, it's still everything I said up here is still true, but now you get to organize order by order in the loop expansion. And so in that loop expansion, you remember when I did it, this started off being S of phi, the classical action, and then there was a first derivative. Let me write this as the integral. I won't write these coefficients explicitly every time, but so I'm doing this expansion here around phi. And phi here, remember, is the argument of gamma, not the classical solution. And so this needn't vanish for typical phi. But we're going to be interested in phi that's kind of near the classical solution. So then this will be something we can perturb in later on. And then we have this quadratic piece. I delta ij plus da 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 da. And so if I plug this into this, do the graphs, and I read off what this is, we found that e to the I gamma phi was integral I. And in that series expansion, you know, this term comes out front, so we have e to the I s of phi. And then we have this Gaussian thing, so we have integral d phi of e to the I over 2, integral of phi I delta I j phi j. And then we had 1 plus all these other terms. And so these other terms include these linear things, include the current things. So the current thing and this thing combined to give us what we were getting here for in this discussion here. What was appearing here was actually the dd phi of gamma minus s. I misspoke when I said that this was the same thing as this. Gamma minus s was the sum of all the graphs, and that was appearing. That difference was appearing because we had gamma was appearing here, and then in the expansion of this, we have something involving the derivative of s. And so what was appearing linear in phi was always the coefficient was always the difference between d gamma d phi and ds d phi. So that's all our vertices involving lines stopping at an x, but there's also the interactions and everything else. So when we do this integral, the leading approximation is this. The next approximation is when we drop everything here, we just keep the 1, and then that's going to be the determinant of delta to the sum power. And then the higher order things will involve the dot, dot, dots here. And so this will be e to the I s of phi. This thing will be the determinant of delta to some power, minus a half typically for bosons, but let me just write it as some power because for fermions it'll be a different power. And then we'll have 1 plus da 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 da. And if I ask kind of which of these things are the terms of the loop expansion, this is going to be the tree level thing, so we have to take the logarithm. So gamma will be s minus I p logarithm of the determinant of delta plus dot, 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 where the dot, dot, dots are all coming from here. So this is what we mean by if we count the powers of lambda, this is the thing that goes like 1 over lambda by assumption. So that's what we'd call tree level or classical. this thing is a thing, if you look at the lambdas, it goes like lambda to the zero, because in the saddle point, the one over lambda out front is going to cancel the phis. And so this will be order lambda to the zero. So this is going to be what we call the one loop. And then the dot, dot, dots that you start off with when you start doing these guys are the two and higher loops. And so that's the explicit translation of the loop expansion into these things, these formal things we're talking about in the path integral. And the important thing I want you to get now is that we're going to often start off with the leading approximation is a classical approximation, in which case gamma is S. And that's kind of why it's one way of thinking about why that is the classical approximation. Okay. So that was kind of a cartoon of what we talked about last time. So I want to kind of formalize now the low energy, high energy split. And to make it concrete, I want to use the toy model. So, but you'll see that what I'm going to say is equally true in general. So for the toy model, so basically the thing is we have a Hilbert space and we have an energy. And if we kind of look at energies, you know, we have various states. But there's a whole bunch of states that were very high energies, so some big scale M. So our toy model, this was the heavy field. And then we had a bunch of light states, which are down here near zero. And so we were interested in physics down here, and we're interested in how that physics depends on this big scale M. And in the example we looked at, it depended in a fairly simple way. If we took advantage of the fact that this scale energy was large, smaller than this M, so we did a Taylor expansion in powers of E over M. So to formalize that, what I want to do is imagine, because these are very different, we have two scales that are very different, we'll take a scale at somewhere a random place in between, and we'll call that lambda. And that'll be our artificial dividing line between low energy and high energy. And we're interested in the question, if we start off with particles and states that are down here with energies that are down here, and we evolve it forward in time, we want to know what do we get? And how does it depend on this big mass, M? So I want to first kind of formally set that up, and then the whole course is about calculating how that works. And the point of this first exercise, the first part of the thing, is to convince you that there exists a Hamiltonian involving only the light fields that describes the evolution of these light particles. Even though we certainly know there's a Hamiltonian that involves both the heavy and the light fields that describes their evolution, because that's how we calculate their evolution in the full theory. But the claim is that there's also a Hamiltonian involving just the light fields that will take any state that's at low energies compared to the scale lambda and propagate it forward in exactly the same way as did the full theory. So there's we know that late time states. So it's always true that at late times, any final state can be written as some time evolution operator of some initial state, where u is e to the minus I h t. So let me write the time dependence explicitly, maybe. So I have some state at t can be written as u of t t naught of some initial state. Where u is e to the minus I h t minus t naught. And h is the thing we built out of the Lagrangian of the full theory. So h is h of all the fields. So let me write them as heavy fields and light fields. So in the toy model, to make that concrete, we had the fields. You remember our original Lagrangian was we had minus 1/2 d mu phi r d mu phi r minus 1/2 m squared r phi r squared minus 1/2 d mu phi I d mu phi I, which is massless. And then we had interactions. So what I mean by these light and heavy fields is what I'll do is in this Hilbert space, since we have a Hamiltonian, we have an energy we know what it means, energy means. What we can do is we can project onto the states that are below lambda. So let's define P sub lambda to be the sum over all states such that their energy of that state is less than lambda of, you know, the Brahe and Ket. So if we'd sum it over all states, this would be one by completeness, but we're just going to sum over the low energy states. So we know in particular that if we take one, I can write, what do we know about the state? We know that this is something which is a projection operator, so it satisfies that p lambda squared, if I just evaluate it, it's a sum over n and m, where the energy of both is less than lambda, of n, m. So by the orthogonality here, this is delta m and n m. So this is, again, sum over n p less than lambda. So that's equal to p. So it squares to itself. That's kind of a classic projection operator behavior. We could equally well have written a projection operator only on the high energy states, and that would just be basically 1 minus p. And that's also a projection operator because of that property. So if we take, if I call q or something, let's call q 1 minus p, then q squared will be, 1 minus p squared, and that'll be 1 minus 2p plus p lambda squared, but that's p, so this is 1 minus p, so that's q. So q and p are both projection operators, that they just basically, p on any state which is low energy gives us back the state. So if psi satisfies that h psi equals e psi with e less than lambda, then p lambda on psi is just equal to psi, and q lambda on psi is equal to 0. And similarly, if chi satisfies that h chi is equal to curly e chi, where curly e is bigger than lambda, then p lambda on chi is 0, and q lambda on chi is chi. So this kind of formally, the assumption we're going to make is that the states that we're interested in initially are in this category. And what we're guaranteed is that because p is defined in terms of energy, it commutes with the Hamiltonian. So we know that p lambda h is equal to h p lambda. Because p doesn't do anything to a state, doesn't change its energy in particular. And so then h just reads off the energy, and then p will give you 0 or 1 on the state depending on what the energy was. But that's true for both sides of this equation. So this is true for, is always true. And that also implies that p lambda times the time evolution is equal to the time evolution times p lambda. So that means that if we project onto a low energy state and we evolve it forward in time, it stays low energy, which is kind of obvious because energy is conserved. So this is kind of formalizing the statement that because so the goal will be we want to focus only on states that p lambda gives us, so these are low energy states, that's the way we'll define low energy. And then because we used energy and energy is conserved, that's something which will be conserved in time. So that if we start off with states that are in this regime, they'll always be in this regime. So the late states will also satisfy the same property, that they are at low energy. So that's kind of a simple statement. And so that means that there should exist. So we could ask, if we given states, so before I do that, so since we know that time evolution is being given, is a full theory is something, we know how to calculate the time evolution for low energies, and the time evolution for the low energy states is time evolution for low energy states. Is given by, well, certainly it's given by the time evolution for any state. So that acting on any state will give you the state in the future. But for states that are at low energies, we could also take this thing, and let me call this u, curly u. I can slap the projection operator on both sides. And for low energy states, the projection operator does nothing, and so this is just the usual time evolution. But for high energy states, this is 0. And so here's another operator which evolves low energy states forward in time. but it doesn't do anything to high energy states. And so if we're never asking anything about high energy states, we don't care that they're different. And so these are equivalent for, so U and U are equivalent, you know, if we only evolve states at low energy. Now the question that I want to focus on, so because U is unitary, curly U is also unitary. So U dagger U was 1, that means that curly U dagger curly U is 1, because U commutes with P. Well, actually it's not 1, it's equal to P lambda, sorry. If you just plug this definition into here and use this, then you get this. And so that means, because it's unitary within the low energy subspace, I can write this as being, I can write it as the exponential of something Hermitian. So I can write curly U is equal to P lambda, or it's equal to e to the minus I curly H of T minus T naught for some curly H. And this is what we, this is what we would define as the effective Hamiltonian. So it doesn't have to be simple, right? It's a, if we were to kind of expand in powers of h, which is needn't be a good approximation when the time difference is large, but if we kind of formally expanded everything powers of h, then if you compare this statement to this statement, that one, you can see that curly h is not just the projection of it's not just the full Hamiltonian with phs on both sides. It actually is more complicated than that. So notice, if I take u is equal to e to the minus I h t minus t naught, and curly u is equal to e to the minus I curly h t minus t naught, and I also use that this is equal to p lambda u p lambda, then you can read off that. I have to have a p lambda here, sorry. I have to have p lambda here because when t is equal to t naught, I want this to be the thing that does nothing to low energy states. So this does nothing to low energy states, but I also want it to not just, I want it to annihilate anything at high energies. So, and I can put p lambda on both sides here because the time evolution will commute with p lambda. So when I do that, I'll put it on both sides. Actually, I don't want it on both sides. I'm trying to emphasize here. If I put it on both sides, I'm going to make it look like it's trivial. But let me make the point I want to make here. So if I just take p lambda u p lambda and I just evaluate that, that's going to be p lambda 1 minus I h t minus t naught plus, let me do the second term too. So it's plus minus I squared over 2 h squared t minus t naught squared. So that'll be p lambda minus I p lambda h p lambda t minus t naught plus minus I squared over 2 p lambda h squared p lambda t minus t naught squared. Actually, I lied to you a second ago. The point I was going to make was a different point. So let me just make sure I make it right here. So if I compare this to this, what I want to say is that curly H is the thing. This is what I did not want to say before, but let me just make sure that the thing I was trying to avoid saying is not quite exactly the same as this. Let me just make sure. I can just see where I'm going to be next. Let me just press on. So this is what I would get by comparing this to this. Yeah.
Why P lambda before behind e to the minus I curly H?
Ah. Hold your thought for a second. I just realized what was confusing me, but say your thing again. Okay, go.
No. I think there should be no P lambda before e to the minus I curly H. Because
here.
Yes. Because e to the minus curly H, I curly H restricts the low energy states.
So it's just a question of whether or not curly U, see the thing is curly U was defined to be, there's a fine here, right? So it has to annihilate all the high energy states because of the P. So it has to be zero on the high energy states and one at t equals t naught. This will be equal to P lambda, not equal to one. So that's what this P lambda is supposed to do. If I didn't have this, then this would be one.
You need to ensure that curly U before high energy states is zero.
Yeah, I'm trying to tie myself in a bit of a knot here, because what I want to really do is I would like to just take my whole Hilbert space to be the low energy theory, and the curly operators are going to be operators I would just define in that low energy theory without making reference to the high energy theory, and that's what I'm trying to do. So this distinction between 1 and P lambda is artificial, because for the low energy theory, 1 is P lambda. So the P lambda is only getting rid of all the high energy states. So if I didn't actually have them in my Hilbert space, I wouldn't need to care about it. So in practice, at low energies, I'm going to be using, I will write this as the exponential, and I won't worry about P lambda, because I'll be thinking of it acting only on low energy states. But in this formal manipulation I'm doing now, the thing that was bothering me, I think I'm happy with now. So it's tempting to say that if I compare this to this, that curly H is just P lambda times H, right? Because that would have been true for this first term. But the problem is that these higher terms, is that the question is whether or not P lambda H squared P lambda is the same thing as P lambda H P lambda H P lambda. And that's not true. So the thing is that this is unequal to P lambda H P lambda H P lambda. If I squared it, it's the same as P lambda. And so the reason they differ is, if I imagine putting a complete set of states between the two H's here, the complete set in this one is every possible state, including the high energy ones, whereas here I'm only including the low energy states. That's the important difference. So the reason that curly H will differ from this is, at higher orders in H, if I looked at, I don't know if you caught what I said there, but if I evaluate the matrix element beta P lambda H squared, or H P lambda alpha, I can put a complete set of states in here and write that as being sum over n of beta P lambda H n H P lambda alpha. And this sum here, because it hits H, is going to be over both low energy and high energy states. But if I had done the same thing here, by putting the complete set of states here, I'm only going to get low energy states because the P lambda picks them out. So this term differs from this term squared because of the inclusion of heavy states here. And so the reason that this curly H is going to differ from just H is that all the virtual effects of it, this is the kind of thing we're trying to capture. The virtual states, the virtual heavy states, they're playing a role in the evolution of the light states, but they're playing a role not in the sense that they're being produced and extend surviving to late times, because energy conservation forbids that, but it's still true that they're in perturbation theory contributing as virtual states. In these Feynman graphs, we have heavy lines, and they would be coming from, you know, in this operator language, they're coming from this kind of a complete set of states. And so the important conceptual difference between curly H and big H is that curly H has to capture the effects of these heavy states, even though we're not inserting them anymore. You know, when we write this thing out, curly H will be defined so that in the series, everybody in the series, and if we put a complete set of states in, is a light state by construction, because this thing was designed to act only on the light states. But this Hamiltonian has to change in such a way as that it captures the missing states that the full theory had. That's what we're trying to design. But so far you see that it has to exist. It doesn't have to be simple the way it has to exist, because we knew there was a unitary evolution because the full theory had a unitary evolution, and all we've done is we've excluded states using a conserved quantity. So if we exclude them initially, they stay excluded because the thing we used, energy, is conserved. So we know there's a unitary evolution. We know that there's a Hermitian thing whose exponential gives us that unitary evolution. But what we don't know yet is that this thing is simple in any way. Even if H is simple, this could be complicated because it's trying to fix up this missing set of intermediate states that the full theory had. So the main exercise will not be, does there exist an effective Hamiltonian? It'll be, is that effective Hamiltonian usefully simple? And so we're going to head to a place where we're going to argue that it's a local thing. It looks just like the classical, the original Hamiltonian did, with different coefficients, but only involving the light fields. And so I want to set that up. So I want to express what it would mean to be, you know, what are we supposed to think of this thing as a function of? And so for the full theory, the Hamiltonian or the Lagrangian was a function of all the fields. So what we need is a notion of what it means to be a light field versus a heavy field. And so we'll again use this projection operator to tell us what that means. So the claim will be that if we write the curly H in terms of the light fields, it has a simple form if we are Taylor expanding in inverse powers of M. In general, it's a big mess, but if we're in this limit where the energies involved are low, so we can do a Taylor expansion, then it'll be simple. So we wish to express curly H in terms of light fields only. So we have to first say what's it mean to be a light field. So we have these. So in a field theory, you know that the basic thing going on with the fields is that you have these particle states. And you can get from any particle state to any other particle state by using creation annihilation operators. And then these fields are just Fourier transforms of the creation annihilation operators. And so the basic statement is that any operator in the Hilbert space can be written as some sum of polynomials of some combination of creation annihilation operators. And there's this kind of a long story there that what's nice about the creation annihilation operators is that they build in features of field theory features of quantum mechanics that you think should be true, like unitarity or cluster decomposition and things like that. But for us, all we care about is that you can always write an operator in terms of the fields, because I can always write any operator in terms of some combination of creation and annihilation operators, and then those I can write in terms of these fields. It may not be pretty, it may not be local, or it may not be special, but there always will exist some way of writing any operator in terms of the fields. So I'd like to write this curly H in terms of the light fields. And so what we have to do is define the light field. So we'll define, and I'll do that for the toy model. So in our toy model, a basis of fields, so anything could be written in terms of, what was this phi I and phi R? And so if I wrote them out, you know, if we in perturbation theory, phi I of x was the sum over all modes of a creation operator, say, or destruction operator for that mode, times some wave function for that mode, and then there's a complex conjugate. So there was a describing the antiparticle in principle, but if for real fields, it's the same. It's just the complex conjugate. And then similarly, we had phi r of x will sum over n of some other destruction operator times possibly another set of modes. I'll just say vn of x. And in practice, on flat space, we were always, these things were possibly, there might have been some polarization vector. We could call it epsilon n e to the I px. The x dependence in flat space is normally simple because we have Poincaré invariance going on. And here, px is short for p mu x mu, or eta mu nu p mu x nu, or minus et plus momentum dot spatial x. So it's a four-dimensional dot product. So, and in particular, we know for all these states, the energy, p0, was the square root of the momentum plus the mass. So for these states, the heavy states, this was the mr, and for the light states, this was zero. So I should label this maybe with the state, with the field. So for the R field, that was true. And for the I field, it was just the square root of p squared. So the natural way to define the light fields is just to say, well, in this sum, let's just pick out the low energy sum, part of the sum, because these are being organized into energy eigenstates. And so so let's do that. So what we'll do is we'll define the light field, the I light field, to be p lambda on phi I of x, p lambda. And we can define the heavy part of I of x to be p lambda on phi I of x, or sorry, q lambda. This is 1 minus p lambda. And similarly, LR of x be p lambda phi r of x. And of course, in this case, this is actually zero, this one. And that's because for these states, everybody in the sum, you know, everybody involved in the sum has an energy which is at least as big as m. And so since we've chosen lambda to be much, much less than m, then everybody in the heavy state sum is actually being projected out by the light guy. Whereas here, these guys are both non-zero because, you know, for the light guy, if p is small enough, then it'll be a light state. But if p is bigger than lambda, then it'll be heavy state. So we really have kind of two notions of heavy fields and one notion of light fields. And what's important about these things is that if we, you know, what I'm heading towards is I want to get back to this path integral way of phrasing things because it's very efficient to organize perturbation theory using the path integral. And the way we got from operators to path integrals was through these generating functionals, that we built things whose derivatives were correlation functions of the light fields, or the fields involved. And we're going to be interested in correlation functions of these light fields. So this is kind of the things we're interested in, because these are the things that act on the light particles, the light sector. And ultimately, what we're going to do is we're going to try and construct curly H as a functional of the light fields and not of the heavy fields, because it's supposed to act only in the light states. And in the same way that these fields phi were a basis for any operator in the full Hilbert space, these guys should be a basis for any operator in the light Hilbert space. And so we know that there exists a Hamiltonian that evolves us forward in the light field sector only, the curly H. And it's also We also know that that thing can be expressed just in terms of this light field and not involve these heavy fields, because it's only acting on the sector for which this is a basis of fields. Because any light operator can be written in terms of creation and annihilation operators for light fields only. And this is the only thing that has the creation and annihilation operators for light fields. So the goal will be construct curly H or a Lagrangian that gives us curly H as a function of the L, I. And we're going to mostly be interested in doing this order by order in 1 over this mass. And that's that last thing that'll make it useful. That in general, the thing has to exist, but it can be a general, it'd be some mess. But once we organize in powers of 1 over this heavy scale, it'll become simple. So the way we'll head there will be we'll set up this generating functional for the light guys. And so we'll look at correlation functions of the light guys. So we'll construct the generating functional for correlations of this L I of X. And if we had more than one of them, we'd want correlations of all of them. In the toy model, we only had one, but in principle, there could have been many. And so we'll be interested in you know, taking the time-ordered product of L I of X 1 of x n, which we so what we'll do is we'll define as before z, well, let's call it curly z, I guess, of j, and I guess I'll use a curly j to be some n equals 0 to infinity of this correlation function. J of x1, j of xn. I probably want to divide by n factorial just to. So this will have the property that if I differentiated n times with respect to j and evaluated j equals 0, I'll pick off one of these correlation functions, and I can get them all this way. And so,
Why do we need heavy and light field and also imaginary and real fields? Like, isn't the real field the heavy field? Isn't that the idea?
Yeah, so that's why this was 0. But the thing I'm underlining here is that we organized it before into real and imaginary, but that actually is not exactly the same as light and heavy, because the imaginary part had both heavy and light pieces to it, because it had the contributions from low momenta were light, but the contributions from high momenta were heavy. If my rule is more energetic than lambda,
right? Okay.
So it's not. You have to keep in mind that low mass particles have high energy states in them, and then those states are high energy, and we're excluding things based on energy. Yeah.
So here there's only one scale at m on.
Yeah.
Because the other one is 0. So
yeah.
What exactly is the expansion then?
It's going to be, you're asking what's the dimensionless thing?
Yeah.
These things are all going to be functions in momentum space of momenta, external momenta, or it could be an amplitude, it'll be center of mass energy. So you'll have a variable, a kinematic variable you use to describe your physical observable at low energies, and it'll be that divided by this m. It'll depend on what you're calculating, but I'm imagining the simplest situation is that there's only one scale at low energies. So if we had had a mass at low energies, supposing the light guy hadn't been exactly massless, then you know, if the energies are of the order of the mass, it means that I'm gonna not distinguish between the light mass divided by the heavy mass from the energy divided by the heavy mass, because I'm gonna imagine I'm in a regime where the light mass and the energies involved for the light mass are comparable. But you could be a more refined, you could do a more refined thing if you wanted to distinguish if the energies was large compared to the mass, say, but small compared to the heavy mass. Yeah, that's another regime you could be in. Okay, so the what I'm doing now is I'm trying to translate lightness into something useful for the path integral. And the path integral is being defined in terms of J. So what we need is some sort of notion as to what J has to satisfy to capture the fact that it's giving you correlations of only the light fields and not heavy fields. That's kind of where I want to go here. And so you can kind of see that the thing that will characterize it will be if I stuck in a bunch of states here, if I put a complete set of states, n, summed over n, in between all these fields, these things have been designed because of the projection operators to only give me light states in here. So that means that if I write out the matrix elements I'm getting, they'll always involve these wave functions here, and they'll only involve the light states. So these wave functions always involved position and time dependence that was controlled by their momentum and energy. And so for the light states, that's always slow. So either the momentum is low, the energy is always low, and the momentum has to be low too, because in the energy goes like momentum squared plus something else. So for the heavy states, there were no momenta for which you had a light field, because the M was always making you the energy too large anyway, no matter how small P was. And for the light fields, if the momentum is small enough, that will contribute in these correlation functions, but otherwise it won't. And so that means that the only thing that will contribute in those correlation functions are things that are varying slowly in space and time, because the restriction that we're below the energy lambda is saying that the spatial dependence and the time dependence will be slower than 1 over lambda. So we're kind of designing this thing so that it has only Fourier components that are smaller than lambda. And so that means that in this overlap, what's happening is that in the overlap, if we had a fast dependence on x here, it's going to die in the overlap because it's going to be folded in with a slowly varying function. If I imagine doing a Fourier expansion of J, all the high momenta are going to be hitting things that they're orthogonal to, basically. So the only thing that's going to survive here in this side of the sum is stuff where J is actually also slowly varying. So what we're going to do in practice is we're going to be interested in taking the generating functional for the full theory, and we're going to be in doing two things. The full theory, I'll write out again what it was, but we had a current in the full theory for each field. We had one for phi r and one for phi I. So we're going to throw away the one for phi r altogether because we're not even tracking that field. And the one for phi I will keep the current for phi I, but we'll only allow that current to vary slowly in space and time. That's what we'll do. And so then we're going to be interested in what kind of path integral expression can we have for that. So curly Z of J will have support only for curly J's varying more slowly, or varying only over distances, varying only over distances and times greater than of the order of 1 over lambda. And because lambda is much less than m, that means this is much, much bigger than 1 over m. Oops. So the important thing, though, is that this whole cutoff thing that we're doing, it sounds like it should depend on the details a lot. It should depend on exactly how I define lambda here. Where do I choose lambda? Does it matter? You know, should I do what I did and restrict lambda, energies to be less than lambda, or should I go to Euclidean space and ask that p squared, the four momentum in Euclidean space is less than lambda, which would have the effect of a similar effect as we're doing here? You know, there's This is a frame-dependent thing. It looks like I'm breaking Lorentz invariance. A lot of things look funny about that, about this. And the lesson will be that this argument shows you that there's something that you can construct, but it's not a useful way to construct it. So when it actually comes to the example time, we'll never go through this exercise again, unless you're doing something really, really simple where the cutoff is not really a problem. And it's much more efficient to set up everything in such a way as to take advantage of all the symmetries. And so in practice, we'll always be using dimensional regularization. And so there will be a point where I'll have to convince you that you can use dimensional regularization, because dimensional regularization keeps momenta right up to infinity. And I'm supposed to be not including those states. But you'll see that all the complications to do with lambda are all things that are at short distances compared to the energies of interest. And so those are all things that can be rolled into the counterterms, the coupling constants in your effective theory that you don't know anyway, or you have to calculate. But most often you don't know what they are. And so it's just an uncertainty, just like in our symmetry story, that you can fix a lot of errors you have in your regularization scheme by absorbing the failure of those things to satisfy a symmetry, by rolling that, compensating for that by breaking the symmetry with your counterterms or with your coefficients in your effective Lagrangian. In the same way, anything that's conceptually weird about this definition of lambda corresponds to just some adjustment of these effective couplings you have in your effective Hamiltonian. And in particular, if you had done dimensional regularization and you had kept high energy states, the difference between what you did and what you wanted is again a high energy thing which you can absorb into coefficients in your effective Lagrangian. So there's enormous freedom in how we define H once we set it up, and we can use that freedom to make the calculation very simple. So what I'm doing here is kind of one of these things that, you know, you do it once to see that the thing you're trying to construct makes sense and exists, and also to see when it doesn't exist, because there will be some situations where it doesn't exist. But then there's much more efficient ways to use it once you have it. All right. So the bottom line is that we wanted a Z for slowly varying J. So you remember that for the toy model, what we had was e to the iw of, I had two currents, one for each one. I'll have a small j, say, and a capital J, which was the integral over phi r and integral over phi I of e to the I action of phi r and phi I, plus I the integral of little j times phi I, let's say, dx plus I times the integral of j, capital J times phi r dx. And what we want is this thing. So what we want is the correlation function for only the light field phi I evaluated for slowly varying modes. So what we want is, if we write curly z to be e to the I curly w of j, then what we want is this should be e to the I w. We want it, we don't want to have heavy fields at all, so we want to set j equals capital J equals 0. And we want to have curly j, or little j, to be curly j. So we want to restrict this guy to be only slowly varying functions. And so if we do this path integral with these restrictions, we will get those correlation functions, which are the ones we want. So far, so good? So now comes the punchline. So now the point of doing this is that this thing, we have some sort of a crank we can turn, which gives us a semi-classical graphical expansion for what these graphs are that give us W, and also what the corresponding gamma is. So I should talk about gamma as well. And the properties of those graphs were all being dictated by these currents. So W was the sum of all connected graphs with these currents as external lines. And then when we did the Legendre transform to get gamma, we chose the currents to be the derivatives of gamma with respect to the fields, and that went through and got rid of a whole bunch of one-particle reducible graphs. And you kind of see now what's going to happen is that we can do the same Legendre transform for curly J, but the graphs we're going to get are going to be slightly different because we're not using this currents that we would have been using in the full theory if we had defined gamma. In terms of W, it's simple to say. We just threw away the heavy J, and we restricted the light J to slowly varying fields, but that has a more involved statement for what is going on for the for gamma. So that's the punchline of this class. So in the full theory, we had gamma. In this case, if we had both fields, we would have curly phi I and curly phi R. It was a function of both of them. And that was defined to be W of J and J minus the integral d4x of curly phi I J minus the of curly phi R capital J, where we evaluated J at where we knew that d gamma, or say dw dj of x was equal to curly phi I of x, and dw d capital J of x was curly phi r of x. So if we thought of this as defining what phi as a function of j was, we were supposed to invert that to think of j being a function of phi, plug that into here, and then read off what gamma was. So this is recall. That was the definition of gamma. And that implied that if we knew what gamma was, we could figure out J because delta gamma delta phi I of x plus J plus little j of x was 0. And delta gamma delta phi R of x plus capital J of x was 0. And so when we went to the path integral form for that, so we, if we plugged in e to the I gamma of phi I phi R, that was the intermediate step was that was e to the I W of J and capital J minus I integral capital J phi R minus I integral little j phi I. And then if we put in the path integral representation for W, and these guys didn't involve anything in the integral, we could just put them inside the integral. We got the integral over d phi I d phi R of e to the I action of curly phi I plus phi I curly phi r plus phi r, then the current coupled only to the fluctuations. We had the little j times phi I plus I times the integral of capital J times phi r. And that was our path integral representation we had for this. And then the choice, the condition that little j was minus d gamma d phi I, and capital J was minus d gamma d phi R implied keep only the one particle irreducible vacuum graphs. So there's a very simple statement about how you, in the loop expansion, would calculate the graphs that give you gamma. And the bottom line was you did the one particle irreducible graphs. And the reason for that was that these currents were being chosen to satisfy this because of the definition of the Legendre transformation, and then those currents went through and they canceled all the reducible graphs. That was the story. So now we want to ask, how does that change? So if we define the Legendre transform for curly W here, what's its expression? And the way we can do that is we know that, I've written it somewhere here. Yes, here. So let's go and see this board. So what I want to use is that for W we knew what the answer was. We're supposed to throw J away and then specialize to slowly varying light currents. So in this whole story, the only difference will be that we won't have this at all, and we will have this, but only for slowly varying j's. That's the only difference. So in this story down here, what will happen is that when we do the path integral, for slowly varying fields, this cancellation will still go through, and we'll still get one particle irreducible graphs. So anything that involves a line, a phi I line, where there is not much energy going through that line, that will also have to be one particle irreducible, because this current will go through and cancel all the reducible graphs. But the parts when there's a phi I line for which there's a lot of energy going through, for which this current is zero, because that's a quickly varying current, and anything involving a heavy line for which that's the current, those aren't there to do the cancellation anymore, because we set them to zero. And so that means that those graphs are still there, so that we're going to be summing graphs that are only one particle irreducible with respect to the light lines. So the modes that have small momentum going through them. And in practice, if you think about it, energy conservation says that if all your external lines are light, then anything, if it's reducible, that line also was light. The energy, the momentum you wanted to flow through that line is light. It doesn't mean the particle type was light. So that in practice, what this means is that graphs that are one particle irreducible with respect to the heavy field are not being canceled. The ones with the light field are being canceled because kinematics of the process will force the energy in that line to be light. The problem with the heavy fields is that even if the kinematics said that there was small energy, the energy of the state that would be in the middle there is going to be heavy because the mass is heavy. So we know that E to the I curly W of J is E to the I W of curly J, and capital J equals zero. So that's the full path integral. And we know that if we define gamma of curly phi to be W of curly J minus the integral of phi curly J d4x, then E to the I gamma of phi will be the path integral over capital phi r, capital phi I, E to the I action of curly phi plus phi I, phi r, plus integral I times curly J times phi I d4x. And then this will be, so gamma will be some, gamma of phi will be some of all, I'll call it one light particle irreducible graphs. So if I have a graph like this, remember these are the light guys, and these are the heavy guys. So a graph like this that's always been killed. Does not appear in gamma, because that line, because these external lines were light, that line has to also be light, because energy conservation says they have to add, whatever comes out here had to be whatever came in. And so this guy is always a light guy, and then this current is always there to go through and cancel this, because there's another graph somewhere. These graphs are there because these currents are present and they're canceling these guys. Whereas this graph, doesn't get canceled, so it you're supposed to keep that one now. Whereas you would not have kept it in gamma for the full theory. Yeah, by assumption, where the external lines are only the ones in the light theory, and so there's no heavy state, there's no R states that are in the light theory. Well, you're worried about what happens when this has actually got a lot of energy in it. But see, the thing is, energy conservation is going to say that this energy has to be the sum of these energies. So if these guys were, if these guys were just crowding the edge, so that they added up, they were all individually less than lambda, so then their sum was above lambda, then it would be true that these guys would be still there. But if these guys were all at very low energies, So you add them up and it's still true, then that'll I'll always be light because of energy conservation.
And so that heavy one would also be like its momentum would just be really off shell.
Yeah, strictly speaking, these guys are off shell, and so it's you have a choice of how you organize perturbation theory. You can organize it so that all the lines are on shell, but then it's not explicitly relative. The relativistic invariance is not explicit. If you're doing a relativistic theory where you're organizing it in the Feynman perturbation theory, then these things would be off shell. And then the statement would be that the four momentum coming in here, it's always a low four momentum, three momentum and a low four momentum. And so then all four of the four momenta are small here. And then the criterion you'd use is that, say, in Euclidean space, Q mu Euclidean, Q mu Euclidean would have to be less than lambda squared or something like that. And because this is a sum of squares, that means all of the components separately are smaller than lambda. So in a relativistic theory, it's kind of a, if you want to keep a formalism where the relativistic invariance is manifest, it's a little bit more subtle. And that's because essentially the criterion of energy is not a relativistic thing, right? If what might bother you now is that supposing I arranged to have some low energy scattering in a relativistic theory, then somebody can come rifling through here really fast and they'll see it as being a high energy scattering. And so the thing is that if you actually looked at the cross section, if you looked at something Lorentz invariant, like a cross section, it'll be a function of the center of mass energy, which is Lorentz invariant. So it's not an observer dependent thing. So when you actually look at a physical thing, the energy that's being compared to the M is always some invariant thing like the center mass energy. So when you actually calculate graviton scattering, say, it's always S over M Planck to some power. And so everybody agrees on the center mass energy. And so the fact that there's an observer for whom all the energies are large is really irrelevant. It's something which it's sufficient to have some observers in a Lorentz invariant theory. If you calculate a Lorentz invariant process, it's sufficient that some observers see a low energy process. And then because it's Lorentz invariant, they're all going to see a low energy process. Invariant things will look like they're at low energies. And the fact that there are high energy observers doesn't matter if the thing you're calculating is like an invariant cross section, because then it's sufficient for one observer to see it at low energies, and then everybody will see the simplification that happens will happen for everybody. And so for the final line is that we compare this. The way that we're gonna, what we'd like to do, the next thing I'll do in the afternoon is we want to write this thing in a way where we just want to call this thing. This is almost what we want, but this is the classical action and it involves fields that we're not following. We're trying to construct the effective Hamiltonian involving just the light field. So what we'd like to do is have something involving only the low energy part of these guys. So if we write d phi r and d phi I, where the momenta are bigger than lambda, so that's the high energy part of the integral, and then we have d phi I, where the momenta are smaller than lambda, then this guy sees the current term, because this has also got a very slowly, only low momenta in it, so there's a non-zero overlap here, but these guys are not appearing here. And so these guys only appear here, so the idea is that we can do this integral once and for all, and we can do that for any value of J. We don't have to know what J is, and the thing is, J is the thing that tells you which correlation function you're looking at, and so which observable you're calculating. And so since you can do these integrals without talking about J, that means you can do them for all observables at once, and calculate what this integral over phi is, and then later on, do the integral over the light fields, which now depend on which observables you're trying to calculate. And that last part, which is the harder part, you can do in this simplified low energy theory. But the thing that we want to calculate, we want to define, we'll call it the Wilson action. And it'll be the integral over d phi r and d phi I, a high momentum part of e to the I classical action. And that's the thing that is what would have appeared like the classical action for the theory that we're trying to calculate. We know this thing has to exist. It has all the information we need at low energies. This is the thing that would look like the classical action for this thing. If only someone could tell us what it was, we wouldn't care about that. That would be the last we'd need to know about the full theory. Because the full theory, the heavy guys are only appearing in the definition of this and nowhere in any of the observables, because we're assuming we're only looking at observables at low energies. So this is the guy that we want to be able to identify. And this is the guy you'll see has all the properties that a classical action has, if you expand it in powers of one over the heavy mass. It's local, it's Lorentz invariant. Anything you'd ask of a classical action, you'd ask of this guy. And this is a very recursive definition. If I did this for scales lambda, you could then do it for scales lambda prime that are smaller than lambda, And you could define a new Wilson action, which is the integral of this guy, in the same way that this guy is, it was the, this Wilson action is the integral of the original classical action. And so you'll see that the, there's really no sense in which the, when you talk about classical actions is kind of an old-fashioned way of talking about things. We really should think of the thing in the path integral as being the Wilson action that we got by integrating out all the physics that was even heavier than what we understood. And so all the steps we're doing are exactly the steps that we should be expecting to do when translating the classical action into the quantum observables. So all the whole rho normalization prescription and all the divergences that happen there and the cancellation of divergences between the having cutoff dependence in the coupling constants, canceling cutoff dependence in amplitudes is all a special case of the story we're telling here. But this way of telling it is nice because this lambda, in the way we're telling it now, the one thing you know about lambda is that nothing depends on lambda, right? Observables don't care about lambda because the full theory, lambda wasn't in the problem. It was something which is a, I've put it in as an artificial distinction between high and low energies. So the one thing you know about lambda is that it doesn't matter as long as you're at low energies. And so you'll see that that's kind of why you don't have to care about the details of how you define the lambda dependence in practice, because it's always canceling. And the and what seemed like a miracle when you do quantum field theory for the first time, that you have a cutoff dependent set of couplings canceling a cutoff dependent of your integrals, is really a special case of the fact that lambda is going to drop out of this problem. And it's going to drop out because the cutoff dependence that's in the integrals is going to cancel cutoff dependence in S, because S explicitly has cutoff dependence in it, because the way I defined it, it had cutoff in it. So the I guess this is the thing that, that appears in the integrals at low energies, and this part of the lambda dependence is appearing in the definition of the action, and they're canceling, and there's no miracle in that. It's just kind of obvious that that had to happen. And that's the modern take on renormalization, that really, it's not a fantastic thing that cutoffs are canceling with coupling constants. It's just a special case of organizing things in powers of scale.
So if some of the input momentum bigger than lambda, so we have to...
Then you have to care, yeah. Then it'll make a difference, yeah. So the whole thing that isn't clear here yet is that, in principle, you could have been hugging lambda in everything I've said, and it wouldn't have been a big deal. But the action you get in general would just be some mess, some non-local mess. And what's going to make it useful is that if you do have a clean separation of scales between the energies of interest to you and the mass in the problem, then this calculation will show you that it's in that limit that this thing, if you Taylor expand this thing in inverse powers of the heavy scale, then it becomes very simple, and then it looks like the classical Lagrangian. So things that you assume in the classical Lagrangian, like locality, will be a consequence only after you've Taylor expanded in powers of the lambda divided by, or the low energy divided by the big scale M. And so it's, if you don't have that hierarchy, then you won't get that simplification. But if you do have that hierarchy, then it'll automatically be true that things are simple. So when you write a classical action down, what you've essentially done is you've assumed that whatever the scale is that you didn't understand, it was a long ways away. So you could do that Taylor expansion. And then the way you should think about your action is that you're organizing it in inverse powers of whatever that scale was. And if you're successful, that means that that scale probably was a long ways away. So let's meet again. I haven't changed the time yet because we had this thing about the are you there's nothing today? Because if things work this week in the afternoon, we can think about changing the time next week. But I didn't want to both try and fix the basic IT problem and the schedule at the same time.